This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with KPTZ Board President and General Manager Robert Ambrose about his past and the future of the station under his direction. And then we talk with the saviors of what is almost undoubtedly the world's oldest surviving luxury yacht, which was recently in Port Townsend for repairs. So now let's go inside the Compass. Faithful listeners of KPTZ can't help but have noticed there have been repeated programming changes in recent weeks on their favorite radio station. Morning shows were shortened to make way for Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which after running for a couple of weeks at 8 in the morning, pushed back to 11 a.m. in response to audience feedback that harsh doses of reality were better taken after a cup of coffee or two. Other news and public affairs programs have appeared, and this week another reshuffling is taking place. What's going on? Well, a lot of it has to do with Robert Ambrose, the relatively recent immigrant from Alaska who has taken on the volunteer title of General Manager and President of the Board, whose experience as the manager of a community radio station in a small Alaska town has led him to believe that local news and non-commercial public affairs programming are the things that make community radio special. In a rare case of KPTZ reporting on itself, I invited Ambrose to my home for this interview.
Why don't you start off by telling me a little bit about your background and how you came? I mean, you're a biologist, right? And you worked as a field biologist for, I don't know, some time, and then somehow wound up managing a community radio station in Alaska. I mean, how did that happen?
It was quite a long route, but I was an ecological geneticist, and I worked in Central America in the early 80s, and then subsequently lived in the Bay Area for a while, where I listened to public radio. That's really where I first started listening, I guess, to stations other than NPR stations, and I became kind of a community radio addict. I looked for that wherever I went. Through circumstances and the search for adventure in life, I guess, we moved from San Francisco to Seward, Alaska, to be able to raise our one-year-old boy outside of a city. And subsequently, we moved to Talkeetna, Alaska, and had a second son. And when you have kids, you get rooted in a place. During that whole time, I had become more and more interested in African music, in the large sense, African-derived music from all over the world. And I wrote for a magazine based in L.A. called The Beat magazine about African music. And then when I moved to Talkeetna, I moved there 4 months after the radio station went on the air, KTNA. And because I was always interested in community radio, I went and got involved and learned to be a DJ. And I started my show Rhythm Connection in 1993. And Talkeetna is about one-tenth the size of Port Townsend. At that time, at KTNA, we only had one staff person and a half-time receptionist. So I worked in various capacities. I was on the board, and I was music director for a while. And
did you not become eventually the general manager?
I did. I had been working with my wife at the time. We had worked at a clinic, a really small clinic that we actually, through 10 years or so, built into a federally qualified community health center. I was development director there, and once we had a new facility built and we had all these programs and 45 employees, then I thought my role was done, just at a time when the longtime manager of KTNA left. So I applied for and took that position as general manager at KTNA, which I held for 6 years.
So How do you define community radio? I mean, what's the difference between community radio and public radio in general?
I guess community radio is as separated from big public radio stations, which are usually urban or are tied to big universities. Community radio station is, I think the function is a little bit different. It's more tied to a specific local area, and it depends on the local community both to support it, but also to give it life, to produce the shows that people want to listen to.
Well, now, so you moved a couple of years ago to Port Townsend, and now you have stepped up to actually become not only the president of the board, but also the volunteer general manager. And you're kind of guiding KPTZ into what you yesterday called KPTZ 2.0. And maybe we could talk a little bit about what kind of changes are coming to KPTZ and why.
Sure. Just to continue with community radio for a minute, I believe that community radio is a really important aspect of democratic society in the sense that at a time when 95% of all media is owned by a few corporations, that the role of community radio must be to give air to other ideas that aren't carried by commercial media. And it's almost like an inverse of what the Occupy movement, their code for the 99% and the 1%. Community radio is like the 1% of radio, and our role is to serve, you know, the 99%, which is different than corporate media. So getting back to why or how I got involved in KPTZ, definitely when thinking about moving out of Alaska after decades there, one of the main criteria on my list was that there was a community radio station, because just a community having a radio station says a lot about the community. It shows that the community cares about its neighbors and has an abundance of energetic people to get it going and diverse interests that keep it going. So Port Townsend had a community radio station. Basically, when I started looking, I looked at Lopez. They have a radio station there. When we did move to Port Townsend, before getting here, I contacted Larry Stein, program manager, and sent him copies of my show because I wanted to get on air, because I like to share this abundance of music that I have that most people haven't heard before. So I did start hanging out at board meetings after I'd been on the radio for a year or so. And then I was asked to join the board, which I did. And then, yeah, I think I reached a point about a year ago where I thought, looking at all the statistics of the radio station, by looking at the number of members and the financial records of KPTZ, that things had been pretty much on a plateau for years and maybe a slight decline in the number of members and the contributions from members. So I thought at that point, either I was going to have to just allow things to continue as they were and maybe focus on my show, or using my experience, maybe try to persuade the board that if we made some changes, it might be a road forward to growing the station and getting more members and therefore more contributions, and perhaps someday being able to have a staff of some kind that is paid with benefits, which is really hard to do now because most stations in the country have money from the Federal Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but KPTZ was born after the CPB basically changed their emphasis and have started actually now defunding small stations to shunt money to the bigger stations.
When did that shift happen?
I think that shift began about 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago. They started raising the amount of money that you had to raise locally in order to be able to get a CPB grant. I think it's going to be something like $200,000 from a community that you need to raise locally in order to get a CPB grant in that neighborhood. And that, you know, Port Townsend, we're nowhere near that amount. And for a place like Talkeetna, Alaska, impossible.
So what is the strategy then moving forward? I mean, how do you think KPTZ can be made more useful to the community and attract greater support from within the community?
At KTNA, it was absolutely clear that the most important programming that we broadcast was local news. We did surveys there, and local news always was the top survey result. We had underwriting like we do here. Underwriters paid more to have their underwriting run in conjunction with local news. And it makes total sense. You know, what do people most need to know about other than what's going on around them? Music is great. Actually, I think KPTZ does a better job than any station that I've listened to in terms of diversity of music presented by experts. But I don't know if that's enough in these days when people can get any kind of music they want to on their phone or on the, you know, through their computer from anywhere in the world. In fact, just recently, a couple of weeks ago, there was an article in Variety magazine that cited a study that had just been done showing that music stations are basically, their market share is drastically declining because people under the age of 25 or so don't listen to radio at all. And so the point of the article was radio has to evolve and change if it's going to remain relevant as a medium and doesn't become extinct like 8-track tapes.
So we're seeing changes now at KPTC. What changes are happening immediately, and what more do you imagine like coming up down the line?
Well, about a month ago, we adjusted our morning schedule to begin broadcasting Democracy Now! As an alternative independent news, national news kind of program. And coming up this week, we're implementing sort of the stage two of our schedule change. And the objective of the schedule change is to remove from our broadcast schedule a lot of the space that had been taken by computerized logs of music that don't have any DJs. And by removing all of those and by organizing the schedule a little bit better, it allows us to make room to build a local news program, which is the priority for the next couple months, to begin having local news twice a day at noon and at 5 o'clock. And also it leaves room in our schedule to add some more informational shows that are syndicated nationally. So we'll be doing that, but it will be done in a way, basically we're preserving, you know, all of the music shows that we have, and we've only had to move a couple of them in order to make a new schedule work. And DJs have been totally helpful in making this happen. Larry Stein and I have been working on this revision for months now, and I think it's just about ready. We don't have the news program built yet, but that will come. And starting this week, we are adding some shows that we hope that listeners will be intrigued by and even challenged intellectually by.
Do you want to name any of those programs?
We have been running Truth, Politics, and Power for a while. We have tried a couple of things once. One show called Making Contact, which is a really interesting show, I think. We're going to add alternative radio, which many people listen to on other stations. There's a program called The Pulse, which is an independent program that goes more into different kind of scientific issues. There's a wide variety of shows like that that we will be broadcasting between 5:30 and 7 in the evening.
And a complete schedule, of course, can always be found at kptz.org, our website.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today. And we'll be talking to you further because there are other changes coming down the pike, right?
There's more change coming and super exciting change, but it's not quite written down yet. So we'll get back to that.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
With KPTZ General Manager and Board President Robert Ambrose, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News.
Rechristening it.
What almost certainly is the oldest surviving luxury yacht in the world was rechristened last week shortly before a relaunch at the Port Townsend Boat Haven. After 3 weeks on the hard, during which her 124-year-old rust-pocked black iron hull was treated with a high-tech epoxy coating called Blue Seal, that her captain, owner, and engineer, 68-year-old Christian Lindt, declares will assure her seaworthiness for at least another century. I first saw the 120-foot vintage vessel with her knife-like prow and graceful fantail stern shortly after she was hauled out, and despite the ample evidence of great old age, I could scarcely believe it when I saw the fading legend painted on her venerable stack, El Primero, Union Iron Works, San Francisco, 1893. Lindt is a John Wayne can-do kind of character, and it was amazing to watch the radical transformation that took place in just 21 days under his hands and those of his tireless friend and partner, Bremerton schoolteacher Melissa Lynch, and a remarkably disciplined crew of painters, plumbers, and other specialists. Everybody seemed to work around the clock, but some mutual friends managed to persuade Lindt and Lynch to take a little time off one morning for coffee and an interview about the boat.
Start from the beginning.
The vessel was launched in 1893, built and designed by the heir to Mark Hopkins' huge fortune, one of the big four of the railroads. They paid $242,000, which equates to about $42 million in today's rates, because at that time, a house in San Francisco cost $1,500.
Union Iron Works in 1893, over by the Potrero kind of Hunter's Point area, down south of San Francisco Maritime
Museum. It was the first yacht built on the West Coast and the fastest yacht up until just a few years ago.
The first steel
hull. Steel yacht.
That's why it's called El Primero.
The number one.
And it was
the Palace Afloat at that time. It had three bathrooms with tubs with running water. At that time, only 15% of San Francisco had running water.
And some other amenities, and it had the radiant heat in there. Yachting wasn't really a true established sport at that time, and so presidents would travel on naval vessels, but this was like a presidential yacht because it wasn't officially a presidential yacht, but it was by actuality because they did travel on it.
And when it was built alongside the battleships Oregon, mm-hmm. Olympia, mm-hmm. and the Gracie S for Spreckel Schuker, which was later became the Wanderer for Sterling Hayden. And mm-hmm. that was a wooden vessel. Well-known going to Tahiti, but the steel frames were made in ironworks. But all four vessels were on the dry docks at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it was built, the El Primero was built with the same integrity as the warships. Mm-hmm. And the warships, mm-hmm. and the Olympia still is in Pittsburgh, which the museum was considering taking it back to San Francisco as a memento of the history and the dynamic role that San Francisco had as largest, it was the largest ship-producing facility in the world. And when they found out the El Primero was still floating, the museums got all excited about the possibility of having it returned to San Francisco mm-hmm. rather than trying to get the Olympia back, because the cost of the Olympia is beyond their ability. But the El Primero, which depicts and shows the same standard of shipbuilding,
craftsmanship.
The man who ran the shipbuilding company, Union Ironworks, then later became Bethlehem Steel, went around the world in the 1890s to learn how to do the proper riveting of a hull, contrary to the to the Titanic, which about 15 years later was done improperly. They did this black iron riveting. They're very innovative. They have double and triple riveted plates, which is very, very rare. At that time, it was innovative. And the tempering of the steel was done in a very proper manner, which they did not do with the Titanic. And the hull of the
If the El Primero had hit the iceberg, it would have survived.
It would have survived. Well, there's several reasons for that, because of the full bulkheads in the El Primero. It's got full watertight bulkheads. The Titanic didn't, and that was a big, big mistake. Several mistakes in the Titanic.
I have to say, I was standing looking at her from the bow before the shrouds went on and hit it. And that bow is like a knife. I mean, it's really slender.
It's beautiful.
Solid steel and cement. And it's reported the previous owner, Sam Perkins, stated that it could hit an iceberg without being hurt at all, which I have consequently hit a cement bulkhead once, and the bulkhead lost the war.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
A line broke in a storm, and so I faltered off the dock, and I was by myself, and I had to get it back to the dock, and in order to get it up to the dock close enough during a storm, I had to put it on the dock and try to jump down and get a line. Mm-hmm. It's very, very hard to do.
How did you come to owner, and when?
I was delivering a fish boat for a friend of mine to Blaine, and I saw this long, elegant-looking hull that was all rusted out, covered in tarps in Blaine, Washington. So I went to the dockmaster and asked him what was happening there with the boat. It looks like it's been abandoned. He said, no, that they've been paying about $30,000 a year to maintain this boat for the last 10 years. The woman that owned the vessel in the state, she had died 10 years ago. And it was just in limbo. Nobody's done anything to the boat but maintain it there. But it was just rotting away. So I ultimately got associated with the owner of the estate trustee. And he had been taking care of the boat. But I asked him if I could help him. And after a few days of helping him, he said they didn't have any more money for the boat. They were going to demolish the boat in about one day. Because Blaine has no foresight, obviously, in anything vintage. So I panicked about that, and I started fixing the boat up, and I got it running. It hadn't run in 10 years, and the owner was so impressed, and we became friends, that he gave me the boat. I offered to tow it for free to someplace, and he just was burned out on it. And so as I was taking it for a sea trial, he came down running the dock with the papers in his hand. He says, wait. And so I stopped and picked up papers, and he'd frankly turned it over to me.
Some background on Christian. He was a tugboat captain for 40 years and delivers boats around the world. The other thing that I just want to quickly say is that I don't think anybody mentioned that the El Primero was originally a steam yacht, and the steam has been converted to diesel, twin diesel. In what year was it, Christian?
1955 to 1960.
So it used to be coal-powered, obviously, and that was, you know, back in the day. And this vessel is a transition piece between sailing power and steam, and wooden boat and steel hull. So this piece is like a museum quality vessel that really shows the transition and how that affected society when all these changes happened. It affected everything, just like the internet affected our life now. This was a big change to go from sailing to steam, and wood to steel.
Well, now there's an old saying, which is that there's no such thing as a free boat. And actually, when I was looking at that, I was thinking, well, now there's somebody's burden. I mean, that, you know, that's a costly vessel, I would imagine, to maintain.
Giving somebody this yacht is like giving somebody a racehorse or a Learjet. It's extremely expensive.
Maintaining
it. And so we've been able to do it. Melissa's helped me a lot. And ultimately, we can donate it to the San Francisco Museum, which is what we're aiming at doing, because we didn't get hardly any support at all in Bremerton. In fact, the administrators in Bremerton didn't really want vessels that are older than 40 years, because they have no purpose in life. Like old people have no purpose in life. And I take it personally offensive. So we brought it here to Port Townsend,
and the reception has been phenomenal.
Unbelievable. I think Bremerton should be ashamed of themselves.
Well, so let's go back to its history a little bit. So you were saying that there have been four presidents on board at one time or another. And why don't you tell us what you know about that?
Well, the pedigree, I think, started actually before the presidents with the owner building the boat. He was quite well known, obviously heir to the Mark Hopkins fame, Hopkins Hotel, top of the mark, and the main orchestrator for the Union Pacific Railroad. But
and the affiliation with the San Francisco Yacht Club.
It was the flagship for the San Francisco Yacht Club, which is the oldest yacht club in the West Coast. And that's where it's going back to, by the way, hopefully. But then it went through very wealthy hands. It went from 1906 earthquake when it changed hands to Thorne of the Thornwood Castle Mansion in Tacoma, and who was also the only banker that survived the depressions of the 1906. And there was many depressions.
And the founder of the Port of Tacoma.
And the founder of the Port of Tacoma. The vessel was on tour to Pacific Expo on its way to Alaska when the earthquake hit, and the owner had to go back. That's Hopkins had to go back to San Francisco to take care of business because they'd lost 20% of the value of Union Pacific Railroad overnight. Because huge depression, all the money was drained out of New York, and so all the stocks went way down, and of course they lost the mansions and all this kind of stuff. So he sold the boat to Thorne, and we have the log of Thorne taking it from Portland.
Do you have a record of what Thorne bought it for?
Yeah, Thorne actually, we don't have a record of that transaction. We're working on that one. The transaction that's of interest is 5 years later, Thorne ended up wagering the vessel in a poker game with Sam Perkins, and he lost it to Sam Perkins, who they were close friends. And so we do have the record, the bill of sale for $1 transferring after the poker game to Sam Perkins, who kept the boat for almost a half a century.
And here's a funny story about Perkins. He was not really a captain, but he ended up high up in politics, and he wielded a lot of influence. He had 7 newspapers at one point in time, and he would dress up in his white suit, and he had a pretend steering wheel secured to the top of the vessel so that he would look like he's driving the boat.
And a blowhorn, even bark orders of heave to there, matey,
Now, no offense to his living relatives. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but it is quite a colorful story, and it is a fact.
Another very interesting point with that the several presidents have been on board, and Taft was, I think, the one of the most colorful. There's a great cartoon about him stepping on the vessel, and the vessel is tipping over because he was quite a large man.
Big boy.
And another interesting article in the Tacoma Tribune is that when the presidents would pick up their hostesses on Pacific Avenue in Tacoma, which is a colorful part of town.
Flamboyant.
And they would take their hostesses below decks whenever the photographers would come around. And boats yeah. Taking pictures. So they were quite discreet about the entertainment part of that vessel.
A lot happened on board. Sure it's what happens in El Primero stays in El Primero.
It's another very interesting episode that Melissa, I think, was entertaining some elder ladies in Bremerton area, and they were quite old, and they were having tea as a gift to them to come visit part of the Historic Society. And one of them speaks up and says, "You know, the first time I saw the El Primero, I was only 9, and my father's pointed out to that boat in the harbor, and he said, my dear, don't you ever get near that boat. It's a very naughty boat." And here I am, she's saying, here I am in the dining salon drinking wine.
A test on the hull while she was hauled out confirmed that the black iron used in her construction originated right here in Irondale back in 1893. So, in a way, the El Primero had come back to her beginnings for the work. With El Primero Captain Christian Lint and First Mate Melissa Lynch, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. The news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.